Hello and welcome to Uncommon Law, my podcast about true stories from my life experience of over 50 years as a lawyer and trial judge. This is a look at the law from the inside out, stuff they don't teach in law school. This is Judge Rudy Greco, retired justice of the New York State Supreme Court. This story is about a young man named Terry, who grew up in a middle-class family. His dad was a doctor. His mother was a housewife. And his father never charged poor patients who lived in his area who came to his office. He was one of, like, the last angry man in the movie. And he was devoted to healing the sick and doing no harm. He was totally devoted. And that's important because that figures later on. Well, Terry grew up, and as a teenager, he was a really good-looking young man. He was tall and lean and athletic. He was about 220 pounds when he was 16 or 17 and about 6'2", and he was a good ball player. He started having problems. His behavior started getting erratic, and he started getting a little bit in trouble, and he started having headaches and some other manifestations of something going on. His mother was concerned, and she started taking him to a couple of doctors, and nobody could figure out anything or what was wrong. And meanwhile, his conduct became more erratic and more serious. One time she came home, and she found Terry in the yard, totally naked, no clothing on, for no reason at all. He was just standing there naked in the yard. Couldn't explain why or anything else. She didn't say anything to anybody. She didn't want to believe it herself, I guess, that he had a serious problem. She was a mother, and she certainly didn't want her husband involved. He was totally busy. The guy would work 18, 19 hours a day. And I think she was afraid of the truth. He was a good diagnostician, and I think she was afraid that he would point out that this was a very, very serious problem. And it got worse. It got worse. He started getting a little bit violent and having some incidents, and she kept covering it up, covering it up, covering it up. And the day came when she came home and found Terry at the kitchen table, smoking quietly. "How are you?" He said, "Oh, I'm okay, fine. Where's Grandma?" "I think she's upstairs." So she went upstairs to see her mother, who's an elderly woman. And there was Grandma in her room, lying on the bed with a bullet in her head. She came down. She saw Terry. She said, "Terry, Grandma is dead." He says, "I know. I know. I did it. I heard a voice, and it told me that I had to kill her. She was the devil. And I did it. So, you know, okay, I did it." Well, they called the police. Mother was terrified. They called the police, horrified. And the police came, and Terry recounted everything to them, and they took him away. The father disowned him. Because as good a man as he was, he couldn't deal with the fact that his son took a life, and when he, the father, had devoted his life to preserving lives, and his own son took a life. They went, after the police processed him, they went to court, and he was represented by legal aid. The mother had no money, and the father wanted no part of him. The case went on, and the judge decided the case, and he could conclude the case in one of two ways. He could conclude it either it was a criminal matter that would call for a prison sentence, or he could find that Terry was mentally ill and start the procedure for a plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, which is an insanity plea in New York. The judge decided, after hearing the police and hearing Terry's testimony, there was no question about what he did or anything else. It was all borne out in the record, his own statements as well as that of the police and the mother and everybody else. The judge played it safe. He treated it as a criminal matter, and he sentenced Terry to 8.5 to 15 years in prison. Terry needed a doctor, not a warden, but he was sent to prison, and because it was a homicide, he was sent to a top security prison, where his illness grew even worse. And he had a very, very tough time in prison. The mother was horrified. The father was totally disappointed and disgusted and dejected. His brothers and sisters were totally sad. It was a real tragedy. He went to prison, and eventually he was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic, which is ironic because in the prison that he went to, which is where he was surrounded by killers, everybody was paranoid, and with good reason. You were surrounded by killers. If you did anything that anybody thought was an offense, they'd kill you. No problem. While he was in prison, after 8 years or so, he killed his cellmate. What happened was, according to eyewitnesses, they were on the softball field, and Terry picked up a baseball bat and bashed the guy's brains in with the bat. He struck him in the head 23 times. And, you know, when it's the bottom of the ninth, it's better to be holding the bat, I guess, than anything else. But there were witnesses that saw it all. They were shocked. And it was, again, a matter of no contest. It was total open record. Well, that's when I came into the picture, because now he was facing a second indictment, probably for manslaughter, maybe murder. And the mother was alone. She was a widow now. She had no husband. He had passed away. She had no money. I knew one of her sons, and she asked me if I would help. So I took it again on a pro bono basis. I didn't want any money. It was an unfortunate situation, and the woman needed whatever help she could get. I went up to the prison where Terry was and had been serving his time, and I spoke to the warden. I was with Terry's brother, one of his brothers, and the warden was one of these guys who was falsely concerned. He was just being cautious. He was a guy that looked like he was always worried that some outsider was threatening his pension, and he wasn't much help. He gave me all the platitudes and everything else, and of course this happened on his watch, so he wasn't too happy about that either. But I did speak to the prison psychiatrist, who was far more helpful than the warden. He was a professional, and he wasn't at stake here. And he told me a very sad tale. He told me that in the 8 years that Terry was in that prison, he had a terrible record. He spent roughly one-third of his time in the general population, one-third of his time in the psych ward, and one-third of his time in segregation, or what they call the hole, as punishment. In solitary confinement, which is cruel and terrible. And the psych ward, to make matters worse, was not a real psychiatric unit. It was just a room that was locked with a bed, and they would handcuff Terry to the bed so he couldn't move, and come in every morning and stuff his throat with meds that they prescribed until he was gaga and, you know, basically insensitive to anything. It was a real tragic story. The psychiatrist told me he wasn't going to get any better. He said somebody made a wrong turn back when they sent him here to begin with. He should have been in the custody of the Commissioner of Mental Health and in a secure mental institution. He says he's not going to change. People like this in this situation, they don't get better. They generally get worse and more dangerous, he says, and he needs, you know, constant medical attention, and you get him out of this terrible, dangerous environment, and he'd do better in a hospital. And he mentioned two hospitals. He suggested two state mental hospitals that would be well-suited places. So now I had an idea of what I was aiming for, and I went and I met Terry himself. And he was not anything like the good-looking young man I had seen in the pictures from when he was 16, 17 years old. He was now about 24 or 25, but he looked 45. He had a buzz cut. He had missing teeth. They were discolored. He had pockmarked skin. He looked gaunt. He didn't have that athletic build anymore. He was still a big guy, but he still had his charm. And we had a conversation with me and his brother and him, and he told me, I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, my cellmate was the guy, and he was teasing me. He was telling me that my name, Terry, you know, my real name is Terrence." He says, "Nah, your real name is Teresa. You're a girl. You're probably a woman. That's probably why they named you Terry, just to cover up that your real name is Teresa." Well, gender confusion in a maximum security prison is a serious piece of work. This is a place where, you know, gang rapes are commonplace. So it's not a good thing to be characterized as anything other than hyper-masculine. And even that has its problems. And he tormented Terry, tormented him, and kept this up for a protracted period of time. And the incident on the baseball or on the softball field with the bat was the culmination. It was destroyed. I broke the camel's back. Terry said, you know, Rudy, I stopped when I saw blood. I'm a born again Christian, you know, and I didn't want to hurt him. I stopped when I saw blood. I said, well, I'm not born again Christian, but I understand. I had faith. I used to be an altar boy. He says, oh, you too. I was an altar boy too. He said, you were an altar boy? I said, yeah, when I was good years ago, when I was a little kid. I said, then I became a lawyer, but we laughed. And we had a conversation, and he told me he liked music. I said, well, what's your favorite, you know, music? He said, and he winked. He goes, Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison album. And he starts laughing. I said, okay, that's pretty good, Terry. I said, we're going to leave. Your brother and I are going to go. He said, well, don't forget, get me out of here as fast as you can. Okay. I said, I'll do the best I can. I can't make any promises, but I'll do the best I can. And he says, send me cigarettes. Send me as many cigarettes as you can. Well, cigarettes are the barter of the prison system. Everything gets horse traded around cigarettes. It used to, and drugs, if you can get the drugs in there. But that's how everybody, that's the currency of the prisons, is used to be cigarettes. Well, I left, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I understood the problem at hand. I was going to try to obtain a plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. And I took home with me that day two full cardboard boxes, which the prison psychiatrist had given me, which was a copy of his record while he was in prison. It was atrocious. Two boxes filled with records of his psychiatric treatment, quote unquote. Time came when he had to be arraigned. It was upstate, in the county where the prison was located. And the judge was a lady, and the district attorney was a young woman. And we did the whole bit of arraigning him, and they charged him with manslaughter. And then I asked for an in-camera or a private conference with the judge and the prosecutor in chambers, in the judge's chambers. And I recounted the story of his background and what the psychiatrist had told me and how sad this all was. And I postulated that I think the judge originally, he made a choice, which he thought was the right choice, but apparently it was the wrong choice. And I think that this second homicide was proof of the fact that they made a wrong choice and certainly underscored the nature and severity of Terry's illness. And I said, he needs to be put into the custody of, taken out of prison and put into the custody of a commissioner of mental health at a secure mental hospital, because society has to be protected from him. He has to be protected from himself. And that would be the best thing. I said, there's no reason, you know, I don't want to see him back on the street. He's obviously dangerous. And to clinch the argument, I went back outside the chambers and I brought in the two cardboard boxes and I said, here's the proof of what I'm saying as to the documentation for his illness and the severity of that illness. Not good. They saw the two boxes and both of them sort of reared up and said, okay, we'll consent to sending him to the custody. We'll take him out of the prison. And he won't go back to the prison. He's in the jail right there in the courthouse. I said, we're going to send him into a mental hospital. And I asked him for the one particular one that was nearby. That was one that was recommended by the psychiatrist at the prison. And the judge said, that's fine. We can do that. That was the good news. The bad news, and the DA consented, that it wasn't permanent. They weren't accepting the plea at that point in time. They said, we're going to send him away for 1 year on a temporary confinement for observation. And we'll see what happens next year. I said, well, it's still better than going back to prison. I wanted to wrap this thing up. Again, I'm not getting paid either. That was another reason to wrap it up. But I thought the outcome was pretty much a certainty if you just looked at it. He said, no, just a 1 year temporary order of observation. Okay. That temporary order lasted 10 years. I went back for 10 years, and every year I got another one-year temporary order of observation. This was like the water torture. Finally, after 10 years, I guess because the case was getting so old, the court was under pressure to get rid of the case and get this thing resolved, they put in a new assistant district attorney. This young lady was actually a boss. She was a bureau chief, and she was a seasoned professional and a very, very totally professional and decent person, which are my favorite kind of prosecutors. We need good prosecutors like this. She was professional. And she and I sat down and discussed the whole thing from the beginning, and she said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want a plea of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, an insanity plea." She said, "Well, I'll consent, but we have to do it my way." She says, "We have to be covered too." I said, "Okay, what's your way?" She said, "You get an expert, psychiatrist or psychologist, a mental health expert, to evaluate Terry and tell us the nature of his illness. And if he's found to be that sick, so as to be unable to face trial, we'll get our expert." She says, "I have an expert. There's a clinical psychologist who used to be an assistant district attorney, and we rely on him. He's very good. He's very straightforward. He's a very decent guy. No monkey business. And he tells it like it is." He says, "If he agrees with your expert, it's a deal. And we'll resolve this. I'll go to the judge with my consent, and the judge will go along with the fact that I consented." I said, "Okay, that's fair enough." So I went back to the office, and I spoke to a suite mate of mine whose sister-in-law was a head clinical psychologist at one of New York City's most famous city hospitals. He spoke to her, and out of the goodness of her heart and just kindness, I guess, to her brother-in-law and pity for the case itself, she said she would come and evaluate, speak to Terry and evaluate and write a report as to his condition, on condition that we agreed that she was going to tell the truth no matter what it was. She had a world-class reputation in her field. She never went to court to testify except in an official capacity on rare occasions, and plainly she was not for sale. And I said, "That's fine. I have no fear of your telling the absolute truth. I am fully confident in the outcome, but whatever it is, it's fine with me. Whatever you say is fine, and those conditions are acceptable." So I was very fortunate to have somebody of her stature step up, and I knew it. She was very gracious. Eventually, we drove up to meet Terry at the prison, and we sat down, and I explained to him, I said, "Listen, this doctor is here on our side. I asked for this doctor to come, and she wants to talk to you. And Terry, you have to be 100% honest. No monkey business, no fooling around. The way you talk to me is the way you talk to her, because she's on our side and she's here to help you." He said, "Okay, Rudy, I'll do that. I can do that. Okay." Well, she interviewed him for 2 hours, and it included a Rorschach test. She gave him a Rorschach test, which is the ink blots and interpreting ink blots. And he answered, and he cooperated, and he was very good, very forthright. He seemed to like the attention from her that she was giving him. And everything went out pretty well, and it finished. And I said, "Okay, thanks, Tara. That's very good. And the doctor and I are going to leave, and we'll be back soon, and I think we'll be going to court pretty soon." "Okay, okay, Rudy." And as he walked off under escort from two of the prison guards, I turned to her, and she was shaking. Physically shaking. I said, "Is everything okay? Are you all right, doc?" She says, "No, I'm not all right." I said, "What's the problem?" She said, "Rudy, do you know anything about these tests?" I said, "No, not really. I'm a layman. Rorschach test." "Well," she said, "he's paranoid schizophrenic. Off the chart. I have never, in my capacity, my entire career, seen or heard of anybody this far gone." She said, "Under a very, very, very thin veneer of normalcy is the most violent and dangerous paranoid schizophrenic that I've ever seen." She said, I can't leave this prison without stopping good conscience, without stopping off to the warden and explain to him that at all times when he's out of his cell, he has to be under at least the custody of two guards, at least two. She says, he's that dangerous. And they must see that he gets his prescribed medications every day. And they must witness it and see that he doesn't. There's no sly or no mug, because if he misses, anything can happen. She said, that's the only thing standing between him and more homicides. She says, I've never seen anything like it. And as for you, she said, I want you to tell me that you'll never be in a room alone with him. I said, okay. I said, but I've been in a room alone with him for 11 years now, 10, 11 years. She said, well, don't you? I thought that was a sobering thought. And she says, okay, don't ever let it happen again. Well, we left. And on the way home, it was a very interesting proposition because we were driving home. It took us 2 hours to get back to New York City. And the doctor said to me, you know, she said, about paranoid schizophrenics, we're learning a lot. It was a big mystery, she said, but the mystery is unfolding now. She said, and there's very strong evidence that doctors believe that they have a common factor in all of these people. One, it is that the mothers in their first trimester in the wintertime had a certain infection. It would lead to a certain nutritional deprivation, which would end up damaging the brain of the fetus and the baby. She said, also, she said, child psychologists can look at infants, little toddlers, in crawling around and tell you by certain actions that paranoid schizophrenia would be in the future of these people by behavioral scientists, she said, behavioral psychologists, and they can pick it out. They can pick out certain traits that manifest themselves later on, as they did in this case with Terry as a teenager, because they don't show until they get into their teen years and they start maturing. So I said, that's very interesting. I said, well, if you're right, then everybody that you're talking about who's paranoid schizophrenic, many of them must be born in October, November, or December. She said, that's right. She said, they would. I said, well, I forget, but you got Terry's file. And she was looking through the file. She says, here it is. Here's his date of birth, October. She said, so he was born in October, so maybe that's what happened to him. We don't know. Push came to shove. Her report went in. It was favorable to me. It was sad, but it was favorable to my aims. And the district attorney took it, gave it to her expert. He evaluated Terry and came back with the same conclusion. I think he was overawed by the credibility of our witness, who was, as I said, world famous in her field. Well, it came time to go to court and enter a plea. And to do that, you have the defendant has to be allocated. The judge will ask him questions. Did you do such and such a thing? Were you guilty? Did you do this? Did you do that? Tell us what you did. Simple stuff, but a record has to be made. And I spoke to Terry outside or back in the pens before. I says, now you have to answer the questions. He says, okay. Now, his whole family was there in the courtroom. And when he came out, I walked out and I met him at the defense table. And the judge said, are you ready? I said, yes, judge, we can proceed. I want to allocute the defendant. I want the defendant to rise. And before he got up, he said to me, Rudy, I don't want to do this. We can beat this case. We can beat this case. I could be not guilty. I could walk out of here. I don't want to do this. I said, Terry, please do what I tell you and answer. You're not going to beat the case. There's eyewitness testimony. There's all sorts of things. It's not going to happen. You're not going to beat the case. You're going to go back to jail. I don't want you to go back to jail. Please, for me, trust me, just answer the judge's questions, yes or no, and tell the truth. Okay? And he looked at me. He says, I don't want to do this. He's whispering. He said, but I love you and I trust you. If you tell me to do this, I'll do it. I said, Terry, please do it. He said, okay, Rudy, I will. And he stood up and I stood beside him and I was in tears. I was crying. And I had to turn my head away from him because he was doing something that was totally against his nature on the basis of my telling him to do it. Well, the record had to be made. The judge made the record. It was brief, but it was touching. And Terry was sent back to the mental hospital, but this time under a permanent order of custody in the hands of the Commissioner of Mental Health with New York State. And people have a misguided or misapprehension of what goes on with these pleas. They watch television, they watch movies, and people enter a plea and it's temporary insanity. Well, New York doesn't have temporary insanity to begin with. And invariably, when they do enter a plea, almost invariably, when they do enter a plea of insanity, let's just call it insanity for shorthand, they end up spending more time in confinement than criminals for the same crime who go to prison. Well, Terry is still in the mental hospital. He's been behind bars, either in prison for 8 years or the mental hospital for over 32 years. He's been behind bars confined for over 40 years, and there was no easy way out. He was a star-crossed young man, and I'm telling you, he's going to be there for the rest of his life. Although I did get a call from one doctor some years ago who said, what do you think about my ordering his release? I said, well, doctor, you know about normalization. You know, the theory prevailing in New York State is this phony theory of normalization. If you want insane people to act normally, you have to put them in normal circumstances. This was a convenient, trite way of emptying out mental hospitals and saving the state the cost of supporting these people. So all of us walk around and we see people on the subway, in the parks, and on the streets, homeless people, and they're mentally ill. And some of them are not dangerous, and some of them are very dangerous, but don't worry, they're being normalized as far as the state is concerned. So this doctor wanted to release him, and after two homicides, and he was cased again, as our doctor said, he was off the chart. I said, I'll tell you what, I would consent to your releasing him under one condition, and that is you bring him home to live with your family so you could normalize him. The doctor hung up. And I will tell you that, as I said at the beginning, the road to justice is sometimes a marathon. In Terry's case, it's been an ultra marathon, and there's no end in sight. Thanks for listening. Come back next week for another episode of Uncommon Law, Lessons They Don't Teach in Law School. I'm Judge Rudy Greco. Court is adjourned.